This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
First to Madison, Wisconsin, then Cairo, Egypt. What they have in common on this Friday. And then, living life offline. You know, it's harder than you think. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions since 1896. Allianzusa.com. And by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the Knowledge Effect.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 18th of February. Good to have you with us. And this is another day of protests. Some in the places that have been in the news a while, several countries in the Middle East, and we will go to Cairo in just a bit. But we begin today in Wisconsin, where a budget deficit and the politics of collective bargaining rights for state workers are front and center. Democratic members of the state Senate have absented themselves to points unknown in order to prevent a vote. Teachers and public sector workers are occupying parts of the state house there. It's a mess wrapped up in a budget conundrum. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the details.
Wisconsin's governor wants state workers to pay for half their pensions, and he wants to limit their use of collective bargaining except for minor wage increases. Eileen Norcross is a senior fellow with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University.
What this allows them to do is alter the formulas going forward. You require workers to put in more of their wages into the pension system to ensure that this can be paid out.
She sees the governor's plan as a pragmatic attempt to address the state's $3.6 billion shortfall.
One of the problems, and not just in Wisconsin, but throughout the country, is that these plans have been undervalued, underfunded, and a lot of that is driven by the kind of benefit enhancements that were granted in the past as a result of collective bargaining, and those things are very hard to undo.
Nationwide, over the last year and a half, about 400,000 public workers lost their jobs. Robert Ward with the Nelson Rockefeller Institute of Government says it's likely to get worse.
During this coming year, nationwide, we will probably see state and local government employment decline by something in the range of 300,000 to 500,000.
Ward says the public sector job losses have had a big impact on unions.
From the union's perspective, it certainly is a big loss of members, dues, and the ability to do the job.
Some see a challenge to the whole notion of unions in this country.
I think in Wisconsin, it is raw politics masquerading as a budget issue.
That's Harley Shaken, a UC Berkeley professor specializing in labor issues.
There is a serious deficit in Wisconsin, but the total potential savings from eliminating unions is about 10% of that or less.
Other governors may also challenge collective bargaining, but Shaken says unions may fight back by using the issue to raise funds and rally the troops ahead of the 2012 election. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
There are more reports today of crackdowns on protesters in several Middle Eastern countries, specifically Libya and also Bahrain, where police opened fire on funeral marchers this morning. There were protests and demonstrations in Egypt today as well, in part to celebrate a week since Hosni Mubarak stepped down, and in part to step up economic pressure on the military government over pay and working conditions. In fact, the army said today a series of ongoing labor strikes are hurting the economy and Egyptian national security, and that the strikes will be, and this is the army's word, confronted. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has been in Tahrir Square all day. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Kai.
So we'll get to the labor strikes in a minute, but I have to tell you, it sounds like a busy night where you are, but more celebratory, really, than protests, right?
Right. I mean, today was a holiday, and there were hundreds of thousands, maybe more than a million people all through downtown. A huge rally in Tahrir Square. They called it a rally of victory and celebration. I can only tell you what it felt like. It was incredibly crowded. Here's what it sounded like.
Mitchell, can you tell us what they're saying?
One of the things they're chanting is the people want to bring the government down.
Well, about the government, Mitchell, and having brought one government down, what's going on with the economy? There are labor strikes there. How's that playing out actually on the streets every day?
Well, right. It's a very uncertain, chaotic situation still. You know, many of the ministers from the former government are still sitting in their fancy offices, drawing their big salaries. The country, in many ways, has ground to a halt. It's not just these rallies, all the military barriers all over the place, which can make traffic even worse. Workers in a host of government ministries are on strike. Oil and soap factory workers, textile workers, the people who work on the trains, bank tellers. Yesterday, 1,500 workers on the Suez Canal went on strike. That's a key to Egypt's economy. For that matter, one-tenth of world trade and seagoing cargo goes through there, as well as a lot of military ships.
Are you talking to anybody who's expressing awareness or concern about the costs, then, of the revolution in Tahrir Square?
You know, there may be disgruntled Egyptians out there. I didn't see any of them in the street today. Now, that doesn't mean people aren't aware of the chaos and how much it's costing. I asked Khaled Daoud about this. He was out for today's rally. He's a columnist at the daily paper Al Ahram.
So you see, for example, people who work for banks, they're on strike because they say, we've been working for 20 years and our salary is like $200, $300, while the manager of the bank, his salary is like $250,000. So I expect this to go on for a while until, you know, everybody gets out their grievances. Maybe we see some serious responses from the new government, the military leadership right now. And probably after that, you will see things calming down. But this is the best time for people to speak out and express their demands.
Obviously best for the protesters, Mitchell. I mean, they've got the momentum. But what about step back for me a minute and look at the bigger picture? People and companies wanting to do business in Egypt, with the government. What are they saying? What's happening with them?
Well, you know, the government estimates the cost for this so far at around $1.7 billion, from the strikes to a huge fall off in tourism. You know, obviously, if things don't settle down, especially once the banks and the stock market open this coming week, the situation could get worse. Investors, foreign businesses could stay away. Rich people could pull their money out. On the other hand, you know, what the Egyptians seem to be saying is, just give us a chance. They do want to try to show the rest of the Arab countries a way forward here.
About those other Arab countries, though, Mitchell, what about the news out of Bahrain and Yemen and Libya today and the way the protests have been put down? How's that news playing in Cairo?
You know, I think most people are not paying attention to what's going on there. They know that they're the vanguard. They're really focused on what moves forward. They don't get oil from there. They don't necessarily need those countries to be stable the way they've been. They're really focusing on what happens next, literally what happens, you know, next week. Do the banks open? And does the government respond to their continuing demands?
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman in Cairo for us. Thanks, Mitchell.
You're welcome, Kai.
Not a lot of protesting on Wall Street today, just more steady gains. Three up weeks in a row for the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Time once again for that thing we do on a Friday, figure out what happened in the week gone by. Here to oblige with our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond are Felix Salmon from Reuters, also Megan McArdle from The Atlantic Magazine. Felix, Megan, good to talk to you both again.
Good to talk to you.
Good to be here, Kai.
So I wanted to talk actually about Wisconsin. and what's going on up there. Not the story itself, Jeff Tyler covered that, but the larger issue. And whether, Megan, we have reached now, not to get all Gladwellian on you, but a point where conversations about debt and deficit and what to do about it might finally get serious.
I think we have reached a point where it's getting serious at the state level already, in part because they're mandated to balance their budgets, with the lone exception of Vermont. They have to balance their budgets. Tax revenues have fallen. And, you know, they managed to paper over this for the first couple of years with tricks, with, you know, moving money between funds, maybe not funding your pension obligation as fully as you ought to. But over time, they've simply run out of the ability to kind of fudge the numbers that way. And so it's getting down to the proverbial brass tacks. We're going to have to start deciding whether we want to cut, whether we want to raise taxes, and how and when we're going to make those cuts or tax increases.
Yeah, but Felix, are we serious about that conversation yet?
In the States, yes, we are. And you can tell that the bond vigilantes have woken up when it comes to the States. You look at...
I love that phrase, bond vigilantes.
The bond vigilantes, they're charging higher interest rates for state debt because they see credit risk there. They see default risk there. And the minute that the bond vigilantes wake up is the minute that any government starts taking fiscal issues seriously. Bond vigilantes have not woken up at the federal level, of course, and that's one of the reasons why the conversations about the national debt are still mostly theoretical.
But wait, Megan, help me out here for a minute on this bond market thing, because it was always my understanding that people weren't so worried about the states because they would be able to solve their budget problems, everything would be fine, and we wouldn't have bond problems. You're telling me now, Felix and Megan, that really it's going to take the bond market to slap people into coherence?
Well, what's really interesting is that when you talk to people who are muni market analysts, longstanding people, they still say, look, we're not worried. Frankly, it's really hard for these states to default the way these bonds are usually set up. The sort of seniority of the obligations and so forth, no one has done so since the Great Depression. And, you know, there's a powerful logic to that. The problem is that when you look back at the mortgage bond market a few years ago, you listen to a lot of bond analysts saying, well, you know, what would take to tank these bonds is a sustained fall in housing prices across the entire country. And that hasn't had since the Great Depression.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, it hasn't happened in a long time, but that doesn't necessarily mean it can't happen. And, you know, there is definitely some worry that the state governors are going to find a way to default or at least defer paying some of these obligations.
Remember, too, that most of the people who buy municipal debt, who buy muni bonds, are not analysts. They're not sophisticated people looking at seniority of obligations and working out the implied probability of default. They're you and me. They're people looking for very, very safe, tax-free investments. And it's quite obvious at this point, they're not very, very safe. There is a risk there. It's not risk-free debt, so they're not buying it. And without individual people buying those bonds, you have to fall back on the institutional market, and they require higher yields.
Well, I don't know about you, Felix, but I personally do not make enough money to qualify to buy tax-free municipal bonds. But, I mean, point taken, it is more ordinary people than analysts, but still quite wealthy people who hopefully know a little bit about the investments they're making.
All right, so let's step back for a second, though, Felix, and take this up to the national level and the bond market there, right? You can go into the market today and get a 10-year T-note for 3.6%, which is, by any measure, is not a terrible rate. When might these bond vigilantes, that phrase I love so much, start getting serious about federal debt?
That's the multi-trillion dollar question. And I think that people are still relatively sanguine that the U.S. government is still, insofar as such a thing exists, risk-free debt, and it probably will be for the foreseeable future.
I always thought it was sanguine, not sanguine.
Hmm.
Felix Salmon at Reuters. You'd think, you know, he speaks the Queen's English. I don't know. Megan McArdle from The Atlantic Magazine. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thanks
for having me.
While there is almost no inflation here in the United States, prices are rising in a whole lot of the rest of the world. And a lot of that increase is being seen in food. A couple of days ago, the World Bank warned that food prices are reaching what it calls dangerous levels. And that's become especially clear in the Middle East. Over the past weeks, protesters from Tunisia to Jordan have complained about the cost of what they eat. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
The main food market in Zarqa, about an hour north of Amman. You can smell the onions and the mint and the parsley. From small wooden stalls, shopkeepers preside over piles of cucumbers and zucchinis. These men are singing a duet about the price of their tomatoes. They're all trying to convince shoppers their produce is the best. They have to, because people are buying less. Like elsewhere in the world, food prices here have been going up, by some counts as much as 8% last year. At this butcher shop, there's a half a sheep carcass hanging in the window, and a few cuts of meat next to it. The butcher's quit stocking his store because nobody can afford to buy. He says it's been like this for the last year. No customers. But he has to charge more for the meat because it costs him more to get it. He says he's living day to day, just trying to survive, which is actually a lot like his customers. While I was talking to him, a woman named Huda Saeed came in with her 9-year-old son. They walked out a minute later without getting anything. I caught up with her outside while she was buying tomatoes. She says she didn't buy any meat because she doesn't have the money. One of her sons, who's a policeman in Amman, supports their family of 7. And he doesn't make enough for her to buy anything but vegetables. There are a lot of reasons food prices fluctuate so much. Bad weather making for poor crops, growing middle classes wanting more energy-intensive food like meat, and using more land to grow crops for fuel means there's less land to grow food. Richard Ferguson is global head of agriculture at Renaissance Capital. He says the higher food prices are hardest on poor people and poor countries.
The average American spends about 9 or 10% of their income on food. But by the time you get to the poorest countries in the world, you're at over 50% of your income. So, that can have a dramatic impact on, your day-to-day living.
Food costs don't eat up quite so much of people's incomes in Jordan, but the country is especially sensitive to higher food prices on the world market because it has to import a lot of its food, almost all of its wheat, for example, and a lot of its fruit. Mohammed Hamdan is an agriculture professor at the University of Jordan. He says countries like Jordan don't have a lot of choices. It's increased food production or increased subsidies. Otherwise, they're subjecting people to the higher global food prices, which has only one outcome.
The nutrition situation in the Arab countries and in the Balkans is getting worse.
And that, he reminds me, is part of what set off protests in Egypt and Tunisia and elsewhere. Back in the market in Zerqa, Huda Saeed can't imagine the situation getting any worse. She says there are already months when her kids don't eat any fruit. But she's still better off than some people. A lot of women she knows can't even afford to buy bread. In Zerqa, Jordan, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up, taking a break from the internet.
Some of my friends have even accused me of abandoning them because I'm no longer on Facebook or in touch about their lives.
Telephone anyone? Hello? Anyone? Bueller? Hello? But first, let's do the numbers. A late run lifted Wall Street into the long weekend. The Dow Industrials gained 73.6%, closed at 12,391. The blue chips did. The Nasdaq rose 2 points, just shy of 0.1%. 28.33 at the bell. The S&P 500 also ticked up 2 points. That's 0.2 there. Ended things at 13.43. Was the market's third straight weekly gain, as I said. Since Monday, the Dow and the S&P each added 1%. The Nasdaq put on 0.9%. In today's action, Caterpillar helped haul up the blue chip index. The machinery maker cranked up 2.4% on news of strong sales. Boeing cruised up 1.1% higher. But Campbell Soup sprung a leak on weak sales despite a cold, soup-friendly winter. Shares lost nearly 4% today. President Obama's dinner in Silicon Valley didn't do much for tech shares. Apple closed down 0.2%. Communications tech firm JDS Uniphase shed more than 5% on a stock downgrade today. Bond prices were unchanged. The yield on the 10-year T-note was 3.58%, which, just for the record, is cheaper than I was talking to Felix about. So there you go. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. It's President's Day. U.S. markets are closed. George Washington's 279th birthday celebration takes place at Mount Vernon. Miss America sings the national anthem. And that's not the only birthday celebrated on Monday. The New Yorker has been published since February 21st, 1925. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, that's American Public Media, and I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you plan to play the stock market at some point in the future, here's a term you might want to know. Limit up, limit down. That's one of the recommendations today from the government panel looking into last year's flash crash. May 6th, it was, when in the space of mere minutes, the Dow Industrials lost 900 points and then just as quickly bounced back. The idea of a limit up, limit down rule would be to keep stock prices from moving so far out of whack that they set off the kind of panic selling that we saw during those stomach-churning moments last May. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more.
Wall Street was founded on the notion that public bidding is the best way to discover a stock's true value.
The problem is every once in a while you're going to get a crazy quote.
Pat Healy is a leading corporate advisor on stock market issues. He says the occasional lowball bid has caused some stocks to experience their own mini crashes in recent months, accidentally or maybe not.
Sometimes it's a fat finger, and sometimes it's somebody fishing for a great price.
So the Flash Crash Committee is recommending a new system aimed not just at trying to slow down a market avalanche. If the panel's limit up, limit down idea is approved, Healy says it would prevent such a pricing slide before it starts.
There'll be a band, a percentage band around the stock. And if a quote comes in for a buy or a sell outside of the band, it'll be rejected by the system rather than stopping trading in the stock.
Other recommendations are aimed at disproportionate orders coming from computerized high-frequency traders. They could be slapped with per-trade fees that can add up on high volume. At Woodbine Associates, market consultant Matt Samuelson says it's feared their heavy order flow can distort pricing.
High-frequency traders use these types of orders and cancel frequently to sort of assess where the market is.
He says much of that is simply probing prices with no real intention to trade. Dennis Kelleher, who heads the D.C.-based watchdog group Better Markets, says it's about time for Washington to do more.
Now, here we are, February 18th of 2011, and we get recommendations on an event that happened on May 6th of last year.
Kelleher says he believes regulators are trying to build on the changes they made right after the flash crash, but he worries they're underfunded and understaffed. The head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Gary Gensler, said today his agency won't be able to protect the American public without additional funding. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
As much fun as it is to be constantly hounded by emails and text messages and always on internet connections, for this next story, we're going to dial things back a little bit to the way things were in, say, the 1970s, before blogs and browsers. Turns out there's actually a movement for people who feel like their lives are being taken over by technology. It's called slow media. Sally Herships has more.
Last fall, Jennifer Rausch's boyfriend was shopping for a melon baller. You know, one of those little metal devices that scoops out perfectly round balls of melon?
He spent hours online at Amazon reading all of the customer reviews of all of these different melon ballers, and he did get a melon baller that he was really happy with for $6, but on the other hand, he probably could have just walked to the local grocery store and bought whatever they had there and been just as happy with it.
Rausch is 41. She's a journalism professor and lives in Brooklyn. She says she wanted to free up her time from the online melon baller searches in life, to spend less time using new media, and to think about how she uses it. So she decided to spend 6 months offline.
What does that mean exactly? Like offline completely?
It means that I have not been using the internet for email, for Facebook, for sharing photos, anything like that, for doing research. I have also not been using a cell phone.
And for the first 4 months, Rouse says she felt fantastic. She knew she'd be without digital resources, so she stockpiled the more traditional kind. Dictionary, thesaurus, phone books. She even installed a landline. But she says her friends are trained to interact online.
Some of my friends have even accused me of abandoning them because I'm no longer on Facebook or in touch about their lives, and I remind them that they can call me anytime they want to and tell me about it in person.
But they didn't. So some of her relationships suffered. And even with all her printed resources, Rausch couldn't find everything she was looking for, like phone numbers and addresses.
Can you just call information, 411?
Yeah, you can call 411.
If you want to pay, and you know exactly what you're looking for. Rausch says it was hard to find things by category, like restaurants. But it turns out she gave herself a tiny loophole. She got engaged, and she needed to start planning her wedding.
Wait a second. So you actually have been going online?
Yeah, for 1 hour a month.
She kept a timer next to her desk. But even with her 1 hour wild card, when the last month of her experiment hit, she was in trouble. The hour went really quickly.
How fast?
Well, the first day.
Rausch was searching, without any luck, for a wedding dress she'd seen in a magazine. Finally, she went online to find the phone number of the dress manufacturer.
And this was during your allotted time?
No, this was after I ran out of allotted time.
You cracked.
I did.
But that was last month. Now the 6 months are up. It's a Saturday afternoon, and Rausch is ready to log on.
All right, are we going to do it?
Sure.
But she says she won't check her email till Monday. It is the weekend. Part of what she's learned offline is to set limits when on.
Don't read your email in the morning. And when you do read your email, don't read every single one of them.
Reading email in the morning lets other people set your schedule. Rausch did log on to Facebook. She hadn't been on the site in 6 months.
I have my fiancé who has posted at least 2 different cute cat videos.
And so this is what you've been missing?
Yeah, this is what I've been missing.
Do we watch a kitten video?
If you want. I love kittens.
Who doesn't? But Rausch says it would be nicer to play with a real cat. She says she's learned she doesn't need to be online. Unfortunately, her friends, family, and work need her to be. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Sally's been covering people trying to unplug their lives for a while now. Her earlier stories are, funnily enough, online at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
These final notes today, first of all, a follow-up to our item earlier this week about the guy in Philadelphia who's trying to foreclose on Wells Fargo. I guess the Wells Public Relations Department finally got wind of the whole thing. Somebody from the bank called him. They're going to work things out. Just thought you'd like to know that. Also, apropos of the story out of Wisconsin this week, there's this from the Pew Research Center. Support for both labor unions and big corporations is at or near historic lows. Pew says 45% of Americans think well of organized labor. 47% view companies favorably. They split, as you might imagine, along party lines. But bad as those numbers are, they beat the heck out of how we feel about government. Just 22% of us approve of it. And that's Marketplace on a Friday from American Public Media. That's APM. Today, the Dow gained 73.6%. The Nasdaq eked out a rise of 2 points, just shy of a 10%. The S&P 500 also ticked up 2 points, 0.2%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is JJ Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, a lot of people say they live paycheck to paycheck. The new online game shows how hard that really is.
The game does a very good job of showing what the reality is. And if you're faced with that reality even over 2 months' time, it becomes very stressful.
It's a tour of the website Spent. Check it out. It's actually really hard. I tried it. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.